The Wazirats was an institution par excellence under the Mughals. It was the main pivot of the administration and the most coveted office in the realm. In the period following the death of Aurangzeb, it assumed new dimensions and became the focal point of court politics and formation of group alliances. For a long time, it determined the relationship between the emperor and the nobility. In its checkered history, it assumed a varying character and passed through a complex process. The Wazirat posed a potential problem in the reigns of Jahandar Shah and Farrukh Siyar. With the accession of Ahmed Shah, it entered a new phase. The Wazirat of Safdarjung, Zamiruddin Siddiqui, Proceedings of the Indian History Congress, Volume 29, Part 1, 1967. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome back to Season 10 of the Islamic History Podcast. This season, we are continuing our discussion on the Mughal Empire. This is Episode 10-5, The Grand Vizier. Ahmed Shah Bahadur. Ahmed Shah Bahadur ascended the throne on 29th of April, 1748, after his father's death. He was 22 years old at the time, and his accession was peaceful without the typical war of succession. His father, Muhammad Shah Rangila, had four wives. Rangila's third wife and Ahmed Shah Bahadur's mother was a dancing girl named Udham Bey. The new emperor's first order was to appoint Safdarjung as his grand vizier. Safdarjung had led the Mughal forces against the Afghan invasion discussed earlier in this season. He had also succeeded Sa'adat Khan as the Nawab of Bengal. Safdarjung was married to Sadrunnisa Begum, Sa'adat Khan's daughter. Now Safdarjung was replacing Kamaruddin as the Grand Vizier. Kamaruddin was killed in the fighting against the Afghans, which we discussed in Episode 3 of this series. Safdarjung had close family ties to the imperial household. His sister had been married to the former emperor, Farrukh Siyar. Her daughter, Badsha Begum, was Muhammad Shah Rangila's first wife. After Safdarjung, the new emperor then appointed Intizam-ud-Dawla as Mir Bakshi, or the military paymaster. Intizam-ud-Dawla was the son of the former Grand Vizier, Kamaruddin. Ahmed Shah Bahadur was raised in the harem and had received very little training to be the emperor. This is not surprising considering how his father had behaved during his three decades as emperor. This lack of experience was exacerbated by the deaths of three important figures all in the same year. Of course, the emperor himself, Emperor Muhammad Shah Rangila, but also the Grand Vizier, Kamaruddin, and the ruler of the Hyderabad, Nizam al-Mulk. The new emperor was not much better than his father had been, and he indulged in debauchery and spent weeks in his pleasure garden. Meanwhile, his mother, Udham Bey, and her eunuch friend-slash-lover, Javaid, managed the affairs of the state. The Rohilas. Back in 1705, Emperor Aurangzeb appointed a man named Dawood Khan as Nawab of the Katihar region. Katihar is in the northwestern Uttar Pradesh state in North India. Dawood Khan was a Pathan from Afghanistan. As the Nawab, Aurangzeb wanted Dawood Khan to build a Pathan mercenary force for the Mughal Empire. The Pathan tribes settled in this region were collectively known as Rohilas. This area became known as Rohilkhand with Bareilly as its most important city. Ali Muhammad Khan, Dawood Khan's adopted son, succeeded him in 1721. When Ali Muhammad Khan died in 1748, there was a dispute over his successor. Emperor Ahmed Shah Bahadur appointed a successor, but the other Pathan leaders refused to accept him. This was a direct challenge to the imperial authority. Before long, Grand Vizier Safdarjung arrived in Rohilkhand with an army to enforce the imperial decision. After securing the imperial successor, Safdarjung returned to Delhi. And as soon as he left, the Pathans attacked and killed the emperor's appointee in July 1750. Well, 2 months later, in September 1750, Safdar Jung was back with another large army. However, despite his greater numbers, the Rohillas managed to defeat the Mughals. One thing to understand is that Safdar Jung was an Iranian Shia and therefore not very popular in the imperial court. This was another example of that Turani-Irani animosity and rivalry that we've mentioned in the past. This defeat in Rohilkhand only deepened and worsened Safdar Jung's unpopularity. Emboldened by their victory, the Rohillas went on to the offensive and pillaged Allahabad and Lucknow. Safdar Jung hired Maratha mercenaries to combat the Pathans, and the Marathas defeated the Rohillas in April 1751. The Rohillas fled to the Himalayan foothills, but the two sides continued to skirmish in the region for some time after that. Today, the region known as Rohilkhand is a part of the Indian state of Uttar Pradesh. It is bounded by the Ganges River on the south and the west, by Uttarakhand and Nepal on the north, and by the Awadh or Oodh region in the east. According to the 1901 census of India, the Pathan population in this region, which was known as Bareilly District, was nearly 41,000. After the partition, however, most of them emigrated to Pakistan. At present, the region known as Rohilkhand is a part of the Indian state of Uttar Pradesh and is bounded by the Ganges River on the south and the west, by Uttarakhand and Nepal on the north, and by the Awadh region to the east. According to the 1901 census of India, the Pathan population in this region, Bareilly district, was nearly 41,000. After the partition, most of them emigrated to Pakistan. As predominantly Sunni Muslims, the Rohillas remained almost in the prolonged conflict with the Shia Nawabs of the neighboring Awadh and were defeated by them in 1774 in the so-called Rohilla War. After that, with the support of British troops, they created the Rohilla state of Rampur, which remained a pliant state under British protection thereafter. The Rohilla leaders sided with the British also during the Sepoy Mutiny in 1857, which enabled them to retain their position in the times of the British Raj. Agnieszka Kuszewicz Fraz, Over the Khyber, Afghans in South Asia, History of Contacts, Politia, No. 40, Modern South Asia, A Space of Intercultural Dialogue, 2016. The Second Carnatic War. In Hyderabad, Nizam-ul-Mulk's death led to a succession war in 1759. On one side we had the following. Nasir Jung, the son of Nizam-ul-Mulk, who was joined by Muhammad Ali Walaja, the Nawab of Arcot. This side was supported by the British. On the other side, we had the following. Muzaffar Jung, grandson of Nizam-ul-Mulk, who was joined by Chanda Sahib, the son-in-law of the Nawab of Carnatic. This side was supported by the French. Nasir Jung and Muzaffar Jung both died in rapid succession during the conflict, and this led to Salabat Jung, who was another son of Nizam-ul-Mulk, becoming the Nizam of Hyderabad. The war ended with the Treaty of Pondicherry in 1754, which recognized Muhammad Ali Walaja as the Nawab of the Carnatic. The Afghans again. Ahmed Shah Durrani invaded India twice. The first time was in 1748, which we discussed in Episode 3. This first invasion ended in a stalemate, but he invaded again in 1752. Ahmed Shah Durrani decided to invade again in 1752. The Mughal governor of Punjab was Moin-ul-Mulk, and he received absolutely no help from Delhi. Well, not surprisingly, he was defeated by the Afghans. With his defeat, Emperor Ahmed Shah Bahadur had no choice but to give Punjab, Multan, and Kashmir to the Afghans. Theoretically, of course, Ahmed Shah Durrani claimed to be ruling in the emperor's name, but he officially annexed all of these territories to himself 5 years later in 1757. The Durrani kingdom now controlled all of present-day Afghanistan and Pakistan. the rise of Maratha power. As we mentioned earlier, three different Nizams had died in a short period of time in Hyderabad. First, there was Nizam al-Mulk, who died in 1748. Then his son, Nasir Jung, was killed in 1750. And finally, his son-in-law, Muzaffar Jung, was killed in 1751. Naturally, this led to chaos in Hyderabad, and this chaos allowed the Marathas to freely pillage across central India. Meanwhile, the Grand Vizier, that is Safdar Jung, he still had Marathas under contract to deal with the Rohillas. During the Afghan invasion, he had suggested to the Emperor that he use the Marathas to fight against Ahmed Shah Durrani and his Afghan army. However, the Emperor declined as he'd already concluded a peace treaty with Ahmed Shah Durrani. Despite all this, Safdar Jung still owed the Marathas 5 million rupees, which he couldn't pay. As we mentioned in the past, the Mughal treasury was now almost completely empty. It had been looted by Nadir Shah, and the Mughals had also made multiple payments to the Jats and the Marathas. With the Marathas furious about not getting paid, they decided to camp just outside of Delhi and began pillaging the countryside. The eunuch, Javaid, who was also the Queen Mother's friend, lover, companion, whatever, he opened negotiations with the Marathas. Well, the Marathas finally agreed to accept a smaller sum than what Safdar Jung had promised. Unfortunately, this only led to more problems for the Mughals. Safdar Jung, who was the Grand Vizier, was furious that Javaid had conducted this deal and gone through these negotiations without his knowledge and without his approval. So he had Javaid murdered, then threw his headless body into the river. Now, obviously, this did not sit well with Javaid's friend slash lover slash companion, the Queen Mother, Udham Bey. Civil War. The Queen Mother, Udham Bey, was determined to get revenge on Safdar Jung for murdering her friend, Javaid. She used her political connections to get Safdar Jung removed as Grand Vizier. Intizam-ud-Dawla, who was the army paymaster Mir Bakhshi and also the son of the former Grand Vizier Kamaruddin, along with his nephew Imad al-Mulk, sided with the Queen Mother to help her in this mission. Imad al-Mulk was only a teenager at this time, and he was also the grandson of Nizam al-Mulk. Safdar Jung had taken the young man under his wing after his father died in 1752. Safdar Jung had even helped Imad al-Mulk gain a position in the emperor's court. Safdar Jung, who was bitter about this betrayal, left Delhi, but he returned the following month with an army of his own. The imperial forces and Safdar Jung's army went to war in early June 1753. The fighting continued throughout October, with Safdar Jung's forces steadily losing control. Even though the emperor had the upper hand, he did not want to fight a long war. So in November 1753, the two sides negotiated a peace deal. Safdar Jung was allowed to remain as the Nawab of Awadh, which would eventually become autonomous just like Bengal and Hyderabad. This peace treaty between Safdar Jung and the Mughals was brokered by Madhavai Rao, who was a son of Balaji Rao and also the Peshwa of the Maratha Confederacy. For his services, the Mughals agreed to leave much of central India, allowing the Marathas to take control. With this, Mughal-controlled territory shrank to present-day western Uttar Pradesh and Haryana. Intizam-ud-Dawla, the army paymaster, the Mir Bakhshi, he became the new Grand Vizier, while his nephew, Imad al-Mulk, took his place as Mir Bakhshi, the army paymaster. These two men were now the two most powerful men in the empire after the emperor, Ahmed Shah Bahadur. Yet, they couldn't stand each other. The Marathas head north. The Jats began looting and plundering Mughal lands just after the Civil War. We briefly discussed the Jats last season. They are a rural ethnic group found in northern India and Pakistan. Imadul Mulk asked the Marathas for help against the Jats. His uncle, Intizamuddala, saw this as an opportunity to get rid of his nephew and the Marathas at the same time. Intizamuddala, the Grand Vizier, along with Safdar Jung, the former Grand Vizier, and the Emperor were all plotting against Imadul Mulk. Now, why did they all conspire against this young man, Imadul Mulk? Well, you have to remember that Safdar Jung had been betrayed by Imadul Mulk, who was something like his protege. Emperor Ahmed Shah Bahadur, he had grown kind of uncomfortable with how powerful Imadul Mulk had become lately. And as we mentioned earlier, there was no love lost between uncle and nephew. Intizamuddala, the Grand Vizier, just didn't like nor trust his nephew, Imadul Mulk. Their plan was to combine forces and attack Imadul Mulk and the Marathas while they were besieging the Jats at Kumher. Kumher is about 124 miles south of Delhi. The emperor brought his mother, Udham Bey, and his harem along on this campaign, which occurred in late May 1754. However, it was Imadul Mulk and the Marathas who wound up getting the upper hand. Somehow or another, they must have learned about the plot and they found a chance to strike first. The imperial forces, the Mughal imperial forces, were routed and fled the battlefield, leaving behind their camp and the harem undefended. The emperor and the Grand Vizier, Intizamuddala, had also fled, once again, leaving the harem, leaving the women behind. The Marathas attacked the imperial camp at Secunderabad, about 30 miles east of Delhi, and the ladies of the harem were attacked, violated, and captured by the Marathas. Two of the emperor's wives, two of his daughters, and the queen mother herself were also captured. The Maratha leader, Holkar, to his credit, made sure the queen mother was treated respectfully. Alamgir II. After this victory, the Marathas sent their demands to the emperor, who had fled back to Delhi. Since they had the harem, the Marathas had all the leverage and they could ask for just about anything they wanted. They demanded the Mughal Empire submit to the Marathas as a vassal. 50 years earlier, it was the Marathas who had been forced to submit to the Mughals, and now the roles were reversed. The Grand Vizier, Intizamuddala, he wanted to go back and fight the Marathas. However, after this embarrassing debacle, everyone else demanded that he and the emperor step down and resign their positions. The next day, Imadul Mulk arrived with the Maratha chief minister and hundreds of Maratha soldiers. With no other options, Emperor Ahmed Shah Bahadur appointed Imadul Mulk as Grand Vizier. Then he issued a final royal decree dismissing all of his nobles. Now in charge, Imadul Mulk ordered the arrest of Ahmed Shah Bahadur, the Queen Mother Udham Bey, and the former Grand Vizier, Intizamuddala. All three were thrown into the dungeon. Meanwhile, a suitable prince was dragged from that same very dungeon to replace the former emperor. This new emperor was Muhammad Azizuddaula. He was the son of Emperor Jahandar and the great-grandson of Aurangzeb. He took the regal name of Alamgir II, but in reality, he was just a puppet of his Grand Vizier, Imadul Mulk. And to make matters worse, Imadul Mulk was also a puppet, but he was a puppet of the Marathas who had, after all, helped him rise to power. The new vizier had been brought up by his Puritan father, Ghaziuddin, with great strictness and austerity, spending his days under the care of tutors and mullahs, and on the Friday Muslim Sabbath with the company of only eunuchs. He was never allowed to mix with children of his own age or attend performances by musicians and dancing girls. The result was precocious intellectual achievement. But this was undermined by unbounded ambition and profound immorality that led to his turning on all who helped him, starting with his patron, Safdar Jung. William Dalrymple, The Anarchy. Mughal Financial Problems. The Maratha services were obviously not free. They demanded 8 million rupees for returning the women of the harem and for helping Imadul Mulk rise to power. However, as we mentioned earlier, the Mughal treasury was empty. So to try to raise this money to pay the Marathas, Imadul Mulk raised taxes and he applied pressure to the local merchants, which in turn led to protests from these same local merchants. The new Grand Vizier, Imadul Mulk, had also built a special force called Shindag during his time as army paymaster. Shindag was composed of soldiers from Badakhshan, which is in Central Asia. This shouldn't come as a surprise since Imadul Mulk was from the Turani faction in the Mughal court. However, due to lack of funds, Shindag had gone a long time without being paid. They finally revolted and assaulted the Grand Vizier, Imadul Mulk, dragging him back to their camp and beating him up. Well, his friends eventually rescued him, and the Grand Vizier then dispatched imperial troops against the rebel soldiers. The soldiers of Shindag, they fought, but they eventually had to flee, and with that, Imadul Mulk confiscated their property. The Mughlani Begum Affair. Mu'inul Mulk was the governor of Punjab who had fought against Ahmed Shah Durrani. He was also Imadul Mulk's uncle. Well, Mu'inul Mulk died in 1753, and his widow, Mughlani Begum, tried to rule Punjab through her son. To further complicate matters, her daughter, Umda Begum, was engaged to Imadul Mulk, the Grand Vizier. Imadul Mulk ordered the two women to be brought to Delhi where they could live as proper Mughal ladies. That was his excuse, at least. However, Mughlani Begum resisted this order since he didn't want to give up her power in Punjab. Finally, in June 1756, Imadul Mulk sent soldiers to the Punjab where they forcibly brought the women back to Delhi. Well, this seemingly minor family squabble would have major repercussions for the Mughals. Even though Ahmed Shah Durrani, the ruler of the Afghan kingdom, even though Ahmed Shah Durrani had defeated Mu'inul Mulk back in 1752, he had developed a great respect for the man. The Afghan king, that is Ahmed Shah Durrani, he even considered the governor's widow like a sister. So he was very angry when he learned that Imadul Mulk had kidnapped her. This was just the excuse he needed to launch yet another campaign against the Mughals. In the next episode, the Afghans prepare to invade India yet again. You've been listening to the Islamic History Podcast, and we hope you've enjoyed the show. You can support the Islamic History Podcast and get exclusive content by subscribing to our premium channel, Islamic History Exclusive. If you're an Apple or Spotify user, open the app and search for Islamic History Exclusive. If you're listening on Podbean, become a patron in the app and you'll get access to our premium content. You can also join by visiting patreon.com/Islamic History. I'd also like to thank Brother Zulfikar Sarosh for his research on the Mughal Empire and his continued support of the show. And thanks to all of our premium subscribers. Be sure to join the Islamic History Podcast Telegram group where you can download a copy of today's transcript. Finally, subscribe to the Islamic History Podcast YouTube channel for our video documentaries. Stay tuned for a short clip from the latest season of the Umayyad Caliphate. Until next time, my name is Muttaki Ismail for the Islamic History Podcast. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Assalamu alaikum Welcome to the Umayyad Caliphate Season 3, presented by Islamic History Exclusive. This season, we are discussing the years 96 to 105 AH, and this is episode 3-5, Omar II. This episode, we'll be discussing the major events of the year 99 AH. And there were two major events this year. First, the death of Caliph Sulayman ibn Abdul Malik, and that ultimately led to the rise of Umar ibn Abdul Aziz as the next Umayyad Caliph. We'll also discuss the political maneuvering to get Umar ibn Abdul Aziz selected as Caliph, which in itself are very interesting. We will also continue our discussion of Khorasan and the origins of the Abbasid Revolution. Let's begin with the death of Sulayman ibn Abdul Malik. As we remember from our previous episodes, in 716 CE, which roughly corresponds to 97 AH, Sulayman ibn Abdul Malik ordered a campaign against the Byzantines. Sulayman wound up taking up residence in Dabiq, which is a village in what is now northern Syria. And he made a vow that he would not leave Dabiq until he had captured Constantinople. Well, the campaign started off pretty good, but it began to falter after Leo the Isaurian became Byzantine emperor. Sulayman ibn Abdul Malik was still at Dabiq when he fell sick, and he died about a week later at the age of 42. Now, we'll discuss the details of his death in just a few moments, but let's go over a few of the highlights from his very brief caliphate. Sulayman ibn Abdul Malik only ruled for a little over 2 years. However, he is generally seen favorably by most Muslim historians. Ibn Sirin had this to say about him, quote, "May Allah have mercy on Sulayman, who began his caliphate by restoring the prayers to their times and sealed it by the appointment of Umar ibn Abdul Aziz as his successor." Unquote. He also dismissed some of the harsh governors that had been appointed during his brother's reign, which brought much relief to the people. Sulayman ibn Abdul Malik also freed many of the people whom Hajjaj ibn Yusuf and the other governors under Khalif Walid had imprisoned. Something else I find interesting is that both As-Suyuti and Ibn Sirin say that Sulayman ibn Abdul Malik restored the prayers to their right times. They seem to allude that the Banu Umayyas or the previous caliphs had deadened the prayers by deferment. I take this to mean, or this sounds to me, as if Sulayman's predecessors allow the prayers to be held at later and later times. Now, I couldn't find any other confirmation of this, but this seems to be the context of the situation based on these statements. Sulayman ibn Abdul Malik died at a relatively young age. To highlight this, I'm going to read a passage from Tariq al-Tabari. Now, this is recorded in Tariq al-Tabari, but the narrator is one of Muhallab's sons, Al-Mufaddal ibn Muhallab. "I went in to see Sulayman at Dabiq on Friday, and he called for some robes. He put them on, but he did not like them, so he called for others, for green Susi robes that had been sent by Yazid ibn Muhallab. After he put them on and arranged his turban, he asked, 'O Ibn al-Muhallab, do you like them?' I replied, 'Yes.' He uncovered his forearms and said, 'I am a king in the prime of his manhood.' Then he prayed the Friday prayers for the last time. He wrote his last will and testament and summoned Ibn Abi Nu'aym, the bearer of the seal, who sealed it." Now let's discuss how Umar ibn Abdul Aziz became the caliph, and to do that we have to talk about a man named Raja ibn Haywa. The primary architect of Umar ibn Abdul Aziz's rise to power was Raja ibn Haywa. Raja ibn Haywa was an Islamic scholar and an advisor to the Umayyad dynasty. He was born around 660 CE during the first fitna. To give you some context, Muawiyah ibn Abi Sufyan became caliph in 661 CE, the year after Raja ibn Haywa was born. So this means that Raja ibn Haywa was 15 years older than Sulayman ibn Abdul Malik, who was born in the year 675 CE. Raja ibn Aiwa also supervised the construction of the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem, and he was involved in many other construction projects at Al-Aqsa.